This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, very disturbing trends across much of the country recently. The number of heroin overdoses has risen dramatically in recent weeks. Officials in many communities from the Midwest to Northeast have seen a huge upsurge of overdoses. They're calling it a public health emergency.
And it is such a disturbing trend. It appears that a strand of heroin cut with a synthetic narcotic, fentanyl, which is 10,000 times more powerful than morphine, underlies this spike in the increasing rate of overdose that we're seeing.
Hospital systems are being depleted of their supplies of naloxone, better known as Narcan, which can save lives in overdose victims if it's administered in time, but it's in short supply in many of these hardest hit communities.
This is just another terrible chapter in the opioid crisis, Mark, and I think we have to brace ourselves for more of these episodes.
There's another prevalent cause of death that people don't often think about, Margaret, and we're going to hear today from Dr. Martin McCary, Johns Hopkins surgeon and leading patient safety researcher. His research has determined that medical errors are the third leading cause of death behind heart disease and cancer.
And we look forward to hearing from Dr. McCary on his important patient safety research.
Laurie Robinson also stops by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Martin McCary in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Coming soon to a pharmacy near you, EpiPen, the generic version. The embattled pharmaceutical company Mylan, embroiled in a consumer backlash over dramatically hiked prices for its life-saving EpiPen, has responded to the criticism, announcing plans to create a generic version, which will sell for about $300 versus the roughly $600 for the name brand version. Mylan's CEO's initial response to the consumer outcry was to offer discount coupons for consumers who couldn't afford the high price tag of the antidote to life-threatening allergic reactions. But the company left the high price of the EpiPen in place. The generic version should be available within a few months. But many school districts around the country are still worried they won't be able to keep enough EpiPens in stock. Speaking of school, it's a time when kids of all ages test their grit on the gridiron, the soccer field, lacrosse, and more, and concussions become a frequent occurrence. It turns out taking young athletes out of play immediately upon experiencing a head injury lets the brain heal faster, getting those kids ready for play much sooner. A study done at the University of Arkansas found kids who were removed immediately after a concussion took 22 days to recover from their head injury. Kids who were hit but stayed in the game for the duration took 44 days or more to recover from concussion symptoms. Zika making the rounds. Cases of the mosquito-borne disease have turned up halfway around the world in Singapore. Some countries are issuing travel warnings. And pregnant women have more to worry about regarding their unborn fetuses and Zika exposure. In addition to microcephaly and several other neurological disorders, about 6% of babies exposed in utero were born with significant hearing loss as well. And every dog must have its day, and they also apparently know what you say. Brain researchers have confirmed what millions of dog owners already know. They understand not just the words you use, but respond to your tone as well. Researchers in Hungary mapped brain responses in dogs receiving things like praise, and the reward center of the brain instantly lit up. Researchers were surprised to find similarities between dogs and humans. The left hemisphere, which is central to language and cognitive meaning, lit up every time a dog heard his master say certain things. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital and professor of health policy at Bloomberg School of Health. Dr. McCary is an international expert on patient safety, is an advocate for transparency in medicine, having co-created the surgical checklist, an initiative several years ago. He served in a leadership role at the World Health Organization. Dr. McCary is a New York Times best-selling author of Unaccountable, which outlines flaws in the American American healthcare system and ways to improve it. He earned his undergraduate degree at Bucknell, his Master's of Public Health from Harvard, his medical degree from Thomas Jefferson University, and he did his residency at Georgetown. Dr. McCary, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Great, thank you.
Too many patients suffer harm in the U.S. health system, but until the Institute of Medicine released its seminal report to Error is Human back in 1999, the issue of medical errors and their link to premature deaths had not been fully understood. And you recently released the results of a longitudinal study that took a look at the problem of deaths due to medical errors, and you concluded that it's now the third leading cause of death in this country. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners about your study.
We had an incident where a patient died directly from a medical error after surgery. And in filling out the death certificate, where it asks you what was the immediate cause of death, we thought, what do we put here? And it turns out that that field in the death certificate populates our country's national health statistics. Well, of course, when someone dies of any type of medical care gone wrong, be it an overdose, be it a preventable surgical complication, the patient will eventually code and go through cardiac arrest, and someone will do CPR, and then you're forced to fill out the death certificate. What do you put? It turns out that the way our country extracts national health statistics and creates that list every year is based on the billing code system. Well, there's no billing code for overdose or preventable complications. So we've basically not been measuring the problem of medical care gone wrong in the United States. You know, it's hard to be involved in a case where someone dies not from the disease or injury that brings them to care, but rather from the care itself. Look, medicine is a wonderful profession. We don't want to create fear. But the reality is that the IOM study from 1999 has no original research. They cite two studies, one from 1984 and one from 1992. They're not great studies. Mm-hmm. And we've been citing this number as if it hasn't changed over the last quarter century or more. Well, all we did is took the most recent studies cited when it comes to a description of how many people die from medical care gone wrong among Medicare beneficiaries, a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, the Health Affairs study. We took the best available, and guess what? It turns out that the range that we report is higher than the third leading cause of death currently listed on the CDC's list. So it turns out that we've got a problem, and that problem deserves the funding and the public awareness that is proportionate to its burden in public health.
Dr. McCary, you pointed out that one of the significant parts of the problem in trying to quantify and address it is usually done through the coding system. The ICD was designed in the mid-20th century to help us understand diagnoses, but we weren't thinking medical errors as part of the equation at that time. And last year, we transitioned the nation's health system to a new version of the ICD codes, which was designed to improve the collection of detailed health data. And what would you want to see within the coding system that would help healthcare institutions give us a clearer understanding of what these medical errors are?
There is tremendous wisdom among clinicians. And if you actually talk to doctors, they'll tell you a lot of people who are making decisions are not asking them for their opinion. People are concerned about this loss of autonomy, and in no other areas and a bigger problem than patient safety. If we look at these ideas on how to deliver care with more reliability, even the NIH get tons of proposals every year from docs on how to design better, safer, more efficient healthcare, but they say we don't have the funding. One of the reasons why we've underappreciated and underfunded the problem of quality and safety in American healthcare is that it's not on the CDC's list of national health statistics. So we've got to realize that people don't just die from heart disease and bacteria. They die from medical care gone wrong, and there's no billing code for medical care gone wrong. And recognize that when someone dies of an unnecessary operation having a preventable complication or a fragmented insurance network that doesn't allow someone to get the appropriate care, that problem is low-hanging fruit. When someone dies from one of those problems, at some point their heart stops, and we know those numbers are overinflated with cases that are downstream cardiac arrest from some other part of the medical care going wrong, leading to sepsis or something else. Look, I'm a cancer surgeon, and as a cancer surgeon, we go through this incredible length to document our cancer statistics in the United States every year, and it goes into our national database at the NCI. We need to treat patient safety the same way, with the same scientific rigor that we use to measure other things in healthcare.
Dr. McCary, as a patient safety activist, you're also an advocate for more transparency in healthcare. In your 2013 book, Unaccountable, you explored how the inherent flaws in the American health systems are exacerbated by a systematic lack of transparency. You say we need a transparency revolution, and how we might better advance as patient advocates transparency in healthcare.
What we've seen is a loss of control over healthcare. Our services as doctors are being bought and sold on a grid like electricity is. And we're the engines for delivering the services, but there's this massive industry behind us buying and selling and trading our services. We don't even have any idea how our services are sold at a discounted rate through employer-based insurance. So this massive industry has grown so large that doctors now feel like they're working in this corporate medicine environment where they're getting crushed. And what you have is record levels of burnout, and you have this system that is really not accountable to anybody. And what I've argued for is, instead of a quality metric from on high, we need to ask the doctor what they think is a good quality metric and then apply that. And we started to do that with our new project, Improving Wisely, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Professional associations of doctors create a quality metric. We apply it to big data, look at the distribution of performance, and just share that data back with the doctors and say, hey, here's how you're doing. Here's how the rest of the country's doing. There's no penalty. We believe in civility. It's for your own improvement. And what we're finding is that surgeons that have operated for 30 and 40 years without a single person weighing in are now saying, hey, how can I do this differently? And it's an exciting time right now. I think if you give doctors the power in healthcare, they have a tremendous capacity to drive improvement.
I want our listeners to know about one of your really remarkable contributions, something that lay people can relate to, and that was the idea of a checklist, the surgical checklist, though not our usual task checklist, fashioned after a routine checklist that pilots go through before they're allowed to fly. I think many people read about it in Dr. Atul Gawande's work, The Checklist Manifesto. I think you both helped the World Health Organization launch a surgical checklist protocol. Tell us about the increased use of checklists in healthcare and what a difference that's made in the surgical arena.
Well, it's interesting. My research partner, Peter Pronovost, had just created a checklist in the ICU for the placement of a central line. And he said, hey, Marty, you're a surgeon. Why don't you come up with one for the operating room? We published a couple articles on it. And then the WHO said, hey, we're looking for projects to base our safe surgery campaign on. Well, we took this checklist, that's sort of a simple common sense thing in healthcare that surgeons really like, and Atul Gawande, who's head of the committee, we presented the surgery checklist I published on. And initially, he didn't love the idea, but then warmed up to it, and of course, popularized the whole checklist in the book Checklist Manifesto. Now our challenge is to tell people this is not the cure-all. You can't just download a checklist and think you've improved patient safety. Any other patient safety tool relies on a great workplace culture of safety. And that's really what we've spent a lot of our time talking about. How do you create a workplace of teamwork and speaking up and eliminating the intimidation that lives in our operating rooms? We've got to work to make sure our nurses feel comfortable speaking up. That's an important safety net in the system. So the surgery checklist was designed to create a discussion so we can address each other with civility and work as a well-lubricated team to get the job done. And what we found is that there are fewer delays and actually fewer complications when the checklist has been implemented.
We're speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. McCary is an international expert on patient safety, is an advocate for transparency in medicine. Dr. McCary, you've noted that there's an unhealthy relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and frontline clinicians, and a recent study revealed that just a simple lunch between a pharmaceutical rep and a clinician leads to higher prescription rates of certain drugs. And you say the tide is starting to turn, but I think I just saw a published results of the dollar amounts that some of noted hospital in our part of the world had received from pharmaceutical companies. And it was supposed to have put public pressure on folks, but it looked like the dollars were increasing. So explain how we might start preventing this relationship from continuing.
Pharma can do a good job educating doctors on some of the scientific developments that we just cannot keep up with. Same for device companies. But what we're all appalled at is when we're treated like you go into a used car dealership and they're trying to pawn off a car on you to meet their 30-day sales numbers. And by the same token, we don't like being treated by our own hospitals or payers to say you've got to see 5 patients in an hour.
Isn't it true, though, that some of the best schools like Harvard Medical School have stopped this practice and, in fact, don't need a pharma, but rather need pharmacists who are trained, who are independent-minded?
Yeah, it is on the way out. You know, GlaxoSmithKline recently announced they're no longer going to pay their sales reps a commission based on sales. And that's the change we want to see industry-wide. Johns Hopkins has banned all of that stuff, the pharma lunches, the gifts. So if we can do that, we can still get by. There's other ways to learn about new drug developments, and we don't have to have this cozy relationship that really polluted fields like macular degeneration, where the Lucentis company pays a direct kickback to doctors based on sales of how much they use.
Well, Dr. McCary, I know you've also participated with journalists from ProPublica who compiled the nation's first surgeon scorecard. The thought was consumers have a right to know. And I understand there was some pushback from the medical establishment over this. So tell us about this, why and how the surgeon scorecard was devised.
We, in our research group, believe firmly that doctors should see their data in a civil fashion. We should be analyzing the data and sharing with doctors where they fall relative to national benchmarks. And we do it in a peer-to-peer fashion. So when the professional society says, hey, here's your data as a courtesy, we're sharing this with you, ahead of what's anticipated to be publicly reported metrics by third parties, here's where you fall relative to the country. And I think when the metric is good, doctors want to see their data. They want to see their average risk-adjusted complication rate using American College of Surgeons definitions. But the reality is other people have access to this data, and when these other parties like ProPublica say, we're sick of this lack of transparency in healthcare, we're sick of, you know, dangerous doctors going without any checks and balances. We want to make data publicly available. That's what third parties are saying. That's what the public is crying for. That's what ProPublica is responding to in making data publicly available. My feeling is if they're going to do it, I want to be there to try to do my best to help guide the data to make it reliable and accurate. Because quite honestly, I found that ProPublica was listening and had good intentions. Now, the public reported surgeon complication rate that they made public was not well received by the surgical community. It's ironic because we've embraced, as a healthcare community, hospital readmission rates. But if you start breaking it down by clinician, a massive backlash that I think was probably related to the way they went about releasing and announcing the data.
You know, Dr. McCary, I was thinking about an interview we did with Dr. Provenost, and he was talking to us about his experience of trying to change the culture within the operating room, and sort of went around the room and said, you know, to everyone outside of the docs, if you saw this error, would you raise your hand? And nobody said, we would never raise our hand. I'm just wondering if the data that you're talking about shouldn't be shared with the team as well. If a provider is deficient in an area, shouldn't every member of the team be aware of that?
You know, I think that docs want to do better. You know, we work hard, right? To become a transplant surgeon, I mean, that is a huge grunt to get there. But when we can engage with doctors, listen to their ideas, and create homegrown metrics that they believe in, then we've really changed things. It frustrates everybody to see the small fraction of doctors that are outliers. And as a profession, we've got to ask ourselves, now that we can measure quality, what do we do when we see an extreme outlier? And of course, most doctors are doing the right thing and all is well. But then you've got a couple that are so far out there is no way to justify anything except incompetent. What do we do with those extreme outliers that we can now identify by name? Do we have an ethical duty to do something about these outliers, I believe we should start by reaching out to that doctor and sharing with them where they stand relative to national benchmarks. If they are extreme dangerous outliers, I think we, in our Improving Wisely project, we turn it over to the association and say, we leave it to you to decide how to go about addressing this issue.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Martin McCary, patient safety advocate, surgeon, and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins Hospital. You can learn more about his work by going to martimd.com. Dr. McCary, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Great to be with you both.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Senator John McCain of Arizona, who celebrated his 80th birthday in late August, is running for re-election. His opponent in the primary made his age an issue, implying that McCain may not live long enough to fulfill another six-year term. Actually, the odds are in his favor. McCain's opponent, Kelly Ward, a doctor and former Arizona state senator, noted that McCain would be 86 years old in 2022, the end of a six-year Senate term. Ward said, quote, "The life expectancy of the American male is not 86, it's less. It's true that the life expectancy is 76.28 years for American males at birth for the year 2013, but life expectancy is actually 88.2 years for an average male who has made it to 80 years old. That's according to the Social Security Administration. Life expectancy at birth is less than it is at age 80 because it factors in mortality rates for all age groups. But life expectancy calculations for an 80-year-old only consider mortality rates for individuals who've already lived to that age. While the average 80-year-old alive today is predicted to live to age 88.2, some individuals may have shorter or longer life spans, depending on environmental and genetic factors. In fact, a study in mice found that genetic mutations inherited from one's mother can speed up the process of aging. Given this research, it's worth pointing out that McCain's mother is still living and is 104 years old. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Depression is extremely common among adolescents in this country, but it's often hard to differentiate between typically teen angst and a clinical condition that requires more immediate intervention. Suicide is the third leading cause of death among 10 to 24-year-olds, a population that almost ubiquitously uses texting as a form of communication.
So if you're someone who's in pain, you text us, and then the counselor on the other side is not working from a phone. They're on a screen that almost looks kind of like Facebook or Gmail.
Nancy Lublin is founder and CEO of Crisis Text Line, an instant texting service designed to encourage teens in crisis to reach out for help. All they have to do is text the numbers 741-741.
When messages come in with certain keywords in them, they automatically get tagged as high risk. So we don't take them chronologically. If you're at risk for suicide, you're automatically bumped up in the queue and you're like a code red. And the supervisor would determine whether or not this person with the imminent harm.
Since she founded Crisis Text, the word has spread like wildfire. They receive an average of 15,000 texts per day from kids experiencing everything from typical teen dilemmas to kids contemplating suicide. Those in most danger are encouraged to take action through a series of channels. Crisis Text Line, an instant, age-appropriate intervention available free of charge and 24/7 to give kids in crisis a lifeline and lead them to help they need. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.